Welcome to The Writing Life, the podcast for anyone who writes. I'm Steph McKenna, Senior Communications and Marketing Manager.
And I'm Peggy Hughes, Chief Executive.
And we're coming to you from the National Centre for Writing here at Dragon Hall in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature. Peggy, it's a back-to-back Peggy Hughes extravaganza this month.
Peg-stravaganza. It's like, I'm like buses. None and then several fly along at once.
Two episodes for the price of one. Well, it's lovely to have you back again. You're always a joy to chat to. And today's episode is all about poetry. And we haven't had, I don't think we've had a poetry-focused episode for a little while now. So this is a treat. Who have we got joining us today?
Well, thank you for having me, Steph. It's always a pleasure to chat to you. Today's podcast is starring Martin Figura, who is an amazingly accomplished poet, longtime friend of National Centre for Writing. And I'll give you a little bit of bio about Martin, shall I? So he's an award-winning poet. His collection and subsequent show, Whistle, was shortlisted for the Ted Hughes Award and won the 2013 Saboteur Award for Best Spoken Word Show. His books, Shed and Dr. Zeman's Catastrophe Machine, were both published in 2016. And the spoken word show accompanying the latter earned Martin a shortlisting in the 2018 Saboteur Awards. And so Martin, yeah, he's an amazingly accomplished and rounded poet and performer based here in Norwich. And it's been lovely to catch up with him about his latest collection.
And Martin's latest collection is called The Remaining Men, and it's just been published by Cinnamon Press. So what did you discuss with Martin when you met up with him in Norwich the other day?
Yeah, so this is an amazingly thoughtful and timely and just lovely collection by Martin. And, you know, I always love to get under the bonnet with any writers, but in particular poets, because there's a magic and a mystery to me to poetry. I mean, I love to read poetry, but, you know, how do they do it? I don't know. Yeah. That's what I want to know. So yeah, we sort of climbed under the bonnet a little bit of Martin's, his process as a poet. You know, where do poems come from, frankly? What's a starting place for Martin in a poem? This collection in particular, as Martin's work seems to me has always done, you know, looks at his family and his relationships and in particular that of his parents. So I was asking him about sort of the ethics around that, the ethics of writing the lives of others. You're not just documenting your own life, but you're documenting the lives of other people. And what duty of care is there, you know, as a writer? We are thinking about what makes poetry an especially powerful vehicle for exploring and articulating trauma and difficult things. I'm asking him quite a bit about some of the figures that come into this collection. You know, he writes about an array of a rolling cast of politicians, which includes Richard Nixon and Clement Attlee and Winston Churchill and so on. And, you know, what made it into Martin? Why did they make it into Martin's poetic imagination and into the collection? And, you know, always interesting to me how a collection gets put together. Why is it ordered that way? What made you put that poem beside that one? What's that flow? So yeah, we go into all sorts of corners, Steph, to be honest.
Brilliant. And as you say, Martin is a long-term friend of NCW and he's a key figure for poetry in Norwich. And he's also written a new poem for us, which was inspired by Norwich as a UNESCO City of Literature. And it forms part of our literary walking tour called Wandering Words. And Wandering Words was launched a couple of years ago by us in partnership with Norfolk and Norwich Festival. And it featured at the time five poetry commissions by poets with connections to our city. And this May, we're relaunching Wandering Words with a new look and two new locations. So Martin's poem, which is brand new, will be featured alongside a new poem by Kat Woodward. And you'll be able to read and listen to the poems online. Or you can download a map from our website and take the walking tour of Norwich for yourself. So to find out more, visit nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk/wandering-words. Now, without further ado, I will pass to Peggy in conversation with poet Martin Figura.
Okay, what a treat to be here today with you, Martin Figura.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, a bit frazzled, but yeah, because I lost track of time, but I'm here now.
But here we are. And yeah. And we just before we stepped into this lovely UEA studio, we were just saying you've been on a brilliant tour and more to come. Tell us a bit about that first.
Well, I got Lewis Buxton asked me to do his Toast Coastal Tour with Laurie Bolger, so it was great. So we did Lowestoft, and then we did Great Yarmouth, and then we did Sheringham, and then just coincidentally I was booked to do CB1 in Cambridge last night, which is where I've started. It's like an open mic event. And so in the sort of mid-90s, that's where I first stood up and read a really bad poem out live. And I've been back, and so that was a really important place for me.
Hugely important. Oh, my goodness. So you'd not been back since?
Yeah, no, I've done it about three times. But obviously I moved out of Cambridge 20 years ago. Wow. But it was a weekly thing, an open mic, crammed into a cyber cafe, hence CB1. Super. If you can remember cyber cafes. Yeah.
I do. Dim and distantly, I do.
Yeah, so it's a bookshop, cafe, internet cafe kind of place. It was really good.
Goodness. And you mentioned this very bad poem. Can you remember the poem? Why was it bad?
I got a book called The Little Book of Harm, which there was The Little Book of Calm out at the time. And I look at some of the things in there, die. This was definitely a middle-aged man at the end of his marriage. you know the kind of thing.
Yeah, wow. I'm sure every single poet has been there. There's some poems tucked away.
Oh, God. Somewhere. Yeah, but a lot of them don't have them published. So,
but yeah. Happily, we are not here to discuss those poems. We're here to discuss a lovely group of poems, a brilliant collection that you've just brought out, Martin, The Remaining Men.
Yeah.
This sort of feels to me a bit both like a State of the Nation collection, a bit of a State of Martin collection too. Can you tell us what this collection represents to you?
Well, it was kind of, because I've done quite a lot of autobiographical stuff, sort of borderline confessional stuff. But I wanted to sort of, you get to an age in your 60s when you start to reflect, you start to look back on your life. And I thought, well, people have heard quite enough about me. And I thought I would sort of almost in a very boring male kind of systematic way go through the years, my beginning in 1956 and work my way through. And just randomly stuff that seems significant or I remember that's never left me. And also there's a couple of poems. There's a poem about the First World War, which really predates it, and the Churchill poem, which seemed to me like the kind of foundations of the national psyche that have never, they've been used and misused. To begin there, that was always the plan. And so I was sort of toddling along. I was writing about politicians, but reducing them to small human stories and stuff. So little human stories is kind of what I did as a photographer and what I do as a writer, I think. And then I started to get commissioned. I got commissioned to do some interviews with army veterans who had post-traumatic stress disorder and what have you, and then the NHS during the pandemic, and then social care during the pandemic. And they not skewed it, actually, it made it a much better thing than it was going to be, I think. So it is a kind of state of the nation, but a bit randomly from my memory as to...
Yeah, wonderful. I want to hear more about that process, I suppose, of putting a collection together. So would you say that while writing these poems, they were always destined to be part of a collection together? Or is it that you sort of take a backward view and think, what have I got that would go into a collection like this?
No, I started writing this collection probably 10 years ago with that in mind. And I've done a lot of work, so the photograph on the cover, I was a social documentary photographer. So, I've always been interested in that aspect. And I've done work with Side Gallery and Amber Films in the Northeast, and in the mining village and what have you. I've done two or three things up there. And they've been documenting the deindustrialization of the Northeast and the impact on working class communities and men in particular, because they were largely male things. And there's so much, gender is a hot topic. And I haven't sort of blundered into that minefield, because that minefield doesn't need another old white man stomping about in it. But it was just too, there is a toxicity to, that pejorative thing of looking at men. And so I just sort of wanted to make a collection or write about men and the impact, I suppose, the patriarchy or the way that society was built and how that's changed and how they've become discarded, that kind of old-fashioned idea that it has an impact on men. And so there's that. I mean, that's one thread of it. And then somehow or other, personal stuff came into it. But it's all that blurred line between personal, social history and political history that I operate in. Yeah. And it seems to work quite well.
Definitely does. I wonder, that's a good second just to tell people about the cover, because obviously we're talking away about this fabulous bit of photography. What's on the cover? What is this photograph?
Well, this is Kenny Robson. So I did this Side Gallery commission. It was Year of the Artist, if anyone remembers that. I think it was about 2000. And documentary photography was, it was all digital then. No one was really interested. And then the millennium came and it kind of woke up the whole sort of documentary genre. So suddenly started to get commissioned, and it came back on the back of a book I did on the army. So I was artist in, or photographer in residence at Horden Victory Club, which is this working men's club for miners in Horden. One of the, there's along that northeast coast, there's sort of a number of mining villages. Easington was the next door village. And this was about 5 to 10 years after the mine closed there. So there's this kind of community. And I went in, and there's some really like made John Davis, Chris Killip, they commissioned a lot of like, and they made some quite famous work there, which was really intimidating. So I decided to shoot it in colour just because there's that sort of black and white sort of genre. First of all, I couldn't compete with who had gone before. And I liked the idea of colour and doing a positive take on it, because they seem very happy to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the main, there was a generation that brought about early retirement, which meant they got paid off, their houses were paid for, they had their allotments, which is a bit reductive way of looking at it, but they were sorted. And actually the life expectancy of a retired miner was like 2 years or something. And so they got this extra sort of chunk of life. But then there was a kind of generation behind them that were kind of not in that position, and it was hard on them. You know, it was definitely a kind of impact on them.
Yeah, it's a wonderful photo. On that, Martin, I mean, you know, you've touched on that idea of this, the small human stories inspiring your poetry. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by people. I had quite an interesting childhood, shall we say. So I occupied many social spaces, working class upbringing, and then with an affluent relative after my mother was killed, and then boarding school. But then when the affluent relatives went to Canada without telling us, and I just didn't get picked up from school, I ended up in a council home. So I was at the same time in the holidays was in a council home and in a prep school during term time. And then various other things. So I lived with it. And then house parents at an approved school took me in, former neighbours, and then I joined the army. So I've operated in loads of different social situations. And I think, and there's always just more to people than you ever imagine. And it's easy to kind of, I don't know, reduce people to a type, or that, because they're outside your social norm. And so that was something. Helen and I did a residency at Lava Ignite Light Club on near the railway station. Not our sort of people at all. And I would just like, I was photographing, Helen was writing. So we're talking, you know, we're talking to them. And it was fantastic. They were self-aware. You know, one of them said, "Am I too orange?" It's just kind of, and they were all great. And they all had, like, you know, and it was just that assumption. There's always more to people, mm-hmm. nearly everyone, than you would imagine. So that always interested me. And there's poems about soldiers in here. So in the creative kind of echo chamber, you know, no one's really sort of bigging up soldiers, so it's quite nice to sort of write, you know, real stories, you know, about real people and the impact upon them that is outside a kind of the norm. So I'm rambling now,
no,
but
you're
yeah,
not. I've you, just you, like you yourself were in the
really
army.
Nosy, you know, and just interested. I mean, that's the thing that really interests me, the sociological and political kind of thing. I don't know, it just always has.
Well, that feels like a good moment, perhaps, to have a poem. Maybe whichever one you would like to maybe one of the army soldier.
I think I'll read Bear, which is this guy Stuart Harris, who's from Rill. On one of their tours, they raided a Croatian warlord, and they found a bear and tied up in the garden. And so he'd really been through it. He was part of a troop of soldiers that were working with the Afghanistani police, and one of the Afghanistani police turned the gun on his colleagues. I think four of them died, and he was a survivor of that. Then he got blown up in Afghanistan in 2012, so it was a lot of impact. His house got burgled after he left the army, so there's a lot of sort of mental health issues and physical. He's an amputee, deaf in one ear, blind in one eye. The Soldiers Charity, who commissioned me to write these poems, he's now an ambassador for them. It's like really turned him around, which is what they do. But this is, it's called Bear. I'll just read the poem. Betrayer will happily walk with you, knows your patterns, the roof runs and dead ends of conflict. Conflict will lift you skyward and lay you down on the broken dirt. Stew woke clean white and wondered if this was hell. The bear in the next bed explained it was Birmingham, and over weeks they reminisced, became firm friends. When it was time, the bear came home with him and was too big for the house. The bear blundered about, breaking ornaments, cracked its head against the light, sent shadows skittering about the walls. The bear brooded and the children shrank back from its rancid breath, which made the bear roar. The rooms of the house became dead ends. One night, Stu placed his hand into the bear's paw, and together they walked to the shingle edge of the sea, and were the most sorrowful sight the sea had ever seen. The sea took pity and let them step into her low swell. They clung together until the sea murmured, "Home." The bear struck out for the moonlit horizon. Stu stood alone on the kitchen floor, water pooled about him. He was so tired, his own undone shoelaces were an unfathomable conundrum.
The most sorrowful sight the sea had ever seen.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
It's a true. So these interviews, mostly people, 90% of it, it was a roller coaster. We were all a team. But then there's just like little gems. And he talked about not being able to do his shoelaces. He forgot how to do his shoelaces up. And the bear, of course. So the bear's a great metaphor for that kind of coming home, and you're going home to your family and having, you know, lots of triggers, and your mental health not being in a good way, and the impact it has on everyone, really.
Goodness me. And that is something I wanted to explore with you about this collection and your work in general, not only this collection, but you talked about kind of the documentary of your own life, but your life features a huge cast of other people, family, obviously you've written a lot about this. I just wondered a bit about that, I guess, that sort of duty of care to others when you're writing their lives. How do you hold that in the balance, or what does that feel like?
I mean, commission poems are kind of thing, because there's an expectation from the people who've commissioned you and who it's about, and then necessarily, in fact, probably not poetry readers, but they're really, the idea of being in a poem is a real, you know, like generally people think that's a kind of honour. It's like a real deal for them. But also you've got a duty of care to, or your own thing. What doesn't want your own poetry community? You want it to be good poetry, but you want it for the people it's about to recognise themselves in it, but also be kind of surprised, like the bear. Stuart never imagined that, and he really loved it. So that when it's about a specific person, then they get to see it, and no one's ever sort of said, I think because the way I write is generally sympathetic. Otherwise, you generalise, and I just think it has to be real. It has to be, you know, you have to be honest with yourself. Don't make yourself the hero of a poem. I've judged some competitions lately, and people are very good people. You know, you get virtue signalling, and, you know, they're writing this about something, and turning their story into art and stuff. Don't do that. So I don't. So they're kind of unsentimental, straightforward, and, you know, use imagery and metaphor. And so the people are generally delighted by them. So I've never been accused in a review or anything of misrepresenting or using. And it's the same as a photographer. I mean, I operate in the same territory that I used to as a photographer.
I wondered what the two gave to each other in a way. What did the photographer, that predates, I think, the poetry and is still absolutely very much in your life. And I just wonder, What does the art of photography bring to your art of poetry?
It provides a lexicon. It certainly did for Whistle, for the early work, and a way of saying the unsayable. And the other thing is, when I did my MA and writing the visual, that it occurred to me that the critical writing about photography and the critical writing about poetry kind of interchangeable. So they operate in a similar way within a frame, and it's just a moment often that, you know, and a detail that gets closely examined. So, and there's writers like John Berger and Roland Barthes were really important. The punctum, don't you know, the thing that you know about the punctum?
No, you're going to tell us.
Camera Lucida is Roland Barthes. And he discusses this idea of the punctum, the studium. And so the idea is if you go and see an exhibition, you buy the postcard. The reason you bought that postcard and stuck it on your fridge is the punctum, because it's something that went through you. Oh. And then studium is all that you know about art history or photography or poetry, which tends to come after the punctum. So it's your kind of rationalising. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be about, you know, I really like that shirt. You know, it's going to look great on me. There's the punctum. And then you go and explain why you've spent 50 quid on a shirt. There's the studium. So it's kind of like that. So it operates in a similar way, I think, and it is interchangeable. And it definitely provided me with a lexicon for Whistle. My father photographs all the time. So, and that was part of my research, was all these photographs, and there's some photos in here. I mean, he wasn't a great photographer, but there's a kind of charm to that. And I still, you know, I'm interested. I've just brought a stack. Like,
what have you brought? A stack of books? What's there?
Yeah, well, there's, I mean, this one, the sort of deindustrialization. Paul Rees was this photographer, along with Martin Parr and people who photographed in the 80s, I suppose, was a heyday. So there's poem Sand, where the committee all wear, can I help you badges, the sort of thing. And the cover has got, you know, I can help. There's this bloke working in the supermarket with I can help. And there's that idea of, like, there's a mining village, the cover of his book, yeah, Flogging a Dead Horse. It's this a kind of virtual, you know, where they heritaged a community and it's all tidied up and smart and clean. And there's ex-miners whose work is holding a big piece of polystyrene painted black as a piece of coal and stuff like that. So the kind of heritage kind of industry. And there was also this wave of new industries as they tried to regenerate areas, and small light industry, which provided a lot of employment for women, but not so much for men. And then 2008 kind of happened, and those communities went by the way as well. And then what do you do? And this is the poem Sand is kind of about a town right in the middle of the country, in the Midlands. It's not like Norwich, hasn't got cobbled streets and churches everywhere and all of that, or a beach or the seaside. It's got nothing, so it kind of tries to reinvent itself.
I think we definitely need to hear Sand. Before we do, though, I wonder, just something you said there about, we talked about excavation or sort of celebrating, you know, smaller human stories, but I think part of this is bearing witness then to changing places, changing times.
Yeah, I think it's easy because my hairdresser, we were chatting while she was cutting my hair, and she's in her early 30s. And so her adult world, you know, just, I mean, things that don't necessarily occur to you, was it's always been pretty bad. You know, she doesn't remember the good times. But, you know, because at the time, I remember thinking that, you know, so as you get on, you think, well, this has happened before and it's a cycle, and then things will pick up, and then they'll drop off again. But it really hasn't picked up this time, and you're waiting for that to happen, and it's 16 years on, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. This is Sand. So we've just sort of said what it's about, so I'll just read it, Sand. And this is probably what sparked the book in many ways. I wrote this quite a long time ago. It's maybe the first poem I wrote in the book. So it's the kind of mindset of what made me think, oh, this is interesting. Yeah, let's sort of look at things. Sand. A little Midlands new town with nothing left to make or do, or mountains to speak of, and no one passing through. The bypass exit sign does not say an historic market town. No stately home, cathedral, cobbled streets, no green or pond, no ducks, no honeystones, second homes, just overspill without blue plaques. The town hall is an office block. Still, they won't just chuck it in and with a grant. Men turn themselves brick by brick into a museum, while their nimble-fingered wives fashion jewellery from circuit boards, components and coloured wires, to stock the shelves by the postcard rack and stacks of books of bygone days. The town has edged itself with sand. The one-way circuit, a never-ending coastal road. Hold a shell to your ear and hear the rush of the M6-M5 intersection. Bunting hangs from shop to shop, the precinct is ablaze, a promenade of windows blind with Union Jacks, a mural by a local artist of our glory days. The marketing's rolled out to Leamington Spa, to Droitwich, to Telford, to Ashby de la Zouche and all points in between. On the next bank holiday, everybody waits. The dripping hanging baskets, the portly mare in chains, the goose-pimpled beauty queen, kids holding maypole ribbons, balloons or flags, the seal knot done up as mods and rockers, ready for the battle of 64, on the hour, every hour, a maze, a brass band tuning up, the lost children's hut, seagulls in a cloudless sky, vendors of buckets, spades and fudges, the committee wearing Can I Help You badges.
Thank you. Gosh, I mean, what you were just saying about your hairdresser, you know, and these difficult years that don't seem to be undifficulting themselves.
Yeah.
For all that, your poems, and you have sort of touched on this a little bit, you know, that lack of sentimentality, are actually a lot of humour and a lot of lightness and a real lightness of touch. And I just wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. How do you achieve that effect, and why is it particularly important to your work to do so?
I mean, it is important. When I started to write Whistle, and there's lots of sort of misery memoirs, and I suppose I probably, if I'd been an Instagram person, started pulling out, I'd be very rich now and famous. But I wanted to not to cheapen it. I wanted to, and I was a kind of performance poet. I said I was a funny guy. I was a funny poet. So I came and did an MA at the art school here, and with George Surtees, writing a visual, which is perfect. And amongst the early reading was Strong Words, book of essays about poetry, one of them by poet Michael Hoffman. And he talks about people. He said that there's an editor he knows. He says sometimes it's like getting severed limbs through the post when he opens it with the poems. And he said, what are people supposed to do with that? It's the reason why the poem gets written. But you know what they're supposed to do? Say, oh, poor you. So all the time I was writing Whistle, I had Hoffman on my shoulder, in my ear, going, oh, poor you. And so I wanted to avoid, and just the way that things, if it's something really hard and difficult, the plainer it is said, and I try and explain this to people, because I get to do a lot of workshops with people trying to write about difficult things, and sometimes they listen, but often, you know, there's blood pouring off the edge of the desk and things. You try and say, it doesn't need it. You know, sentimentality, it's like it's not trusting the reader. And there's William Fine's book Music Room, which is about him and his autistic brother. And William Fine's a very lovely knife, stately home, but he's got this massive brother who has a BO problem, smokes a pipe, is quite physical, and William is quite a little kind of fragile fella. But there's this bond because of that, and he goes off in his gap year, as posh kids do, and he's in, I think, Brazil or something. And so you've gone through this book, and it's just a great book. So you know about this relationship, and you care about him, and you care about his brother. And then while he's away, his brother dies, and there's no big scene. He comes in from whatever, from building a school or something, sits on the bed, and there's a postcard, and he picks it up, and it just says, Rich died this morning, come and join us. And even now, it's like, woo, just like that. And it's not sentimental. It's simple and matter of fact. I just think it works. And if you're dressing it up, you're sentimentality. I think my poems are warm and human, and I like to push up against that line. But it's like an unearned emotion. I think Nathan Hamilton wrote this thing about performance poetry, is that, you know, there's so much unearned emotion out there, because you know there's an American poet who comes out and he's this, and you know he's got it down pat, he's been rehearsing this word for word, and he's, you know, manipulating the audience to good effect.
I think you've just given me a little epiphany there in the middle, thinking about the plain speak of your poetry. You just, so much sits under it. That's left to the imagination of the reader.
Yeah. In the NHS, during the lockdown, there's a poem about the end of life team who were like working really hard, and Hannah McLean, came from an interview, and she like walked into work having been on maternity leave. She came back early. And one day she went into the COVID ward, someone had just died, and she said, well, do you want me to deal with it? And so she dealt with it, and she phoned the family, and she was going to see someone else, some of the palliative care team, but they died already because she'd been dead. And this happened all day, and there were 7 deaths, which, I mean, people die in hospital, but this is an unusually high number. And at that point, she thought, well, what's going to happen tomorrow? Is that I'm going to walk in, there's going to be 12 people, 20 people. But there's stories that, and it was interesting being there with people because it was palpable, the impact. So that was, a massive effect on me. But again, there's like some really simple stories. So she's holding an old man who's going to die within the next couple of hours, and she's having to hold the phone to his ear so he can have a final conversation. He lives, he lives with his son, just the two of them. And it comes down to, he was saying when to plant the begonias out and don't do it too early. And then his son said, I'm going to miss you, Dad. And he said, you can do this, son. And I mean, even now, I read all my Whistle personal stuff, and I always kind of, anyone who gets emotional when they're doing readings, I was very unprofessional. And I think that's a poem that Olivia Colman recorded, a couple of them, and as someone pointed out to me, she cries very easily, but she took her about 8 takes. And she's like all watery
eyes.
Even
Olivia.
Yeah,
Olivia.
Yeah.
I've just got one more question, I think, Marzen, in this sort of area. And I think it's around, I think I'm right in saying the books you've mentioned that have helped you on the road to writing without sentimentality and so on, they aren't by and large other poetry books. I think for nonfiction, there's obviously photography here.
So,
I just wondered, what to your view makes poetry, and especially, if you think this, or you might not, but is it an especially effective vehicle for exploring difficult sort of material, trauma?
I think it's a good way to explore almost anything, really. I think what it does, and what I did a book on the army of photographs. What the great thing about poetry is, so there's, you know, this covers 70 years, and it's just too much. Like Whistle was too much to hold in my head. You know, you're trying to work it out, and so you write a poem on a page, you know, and you put it there. So that's that little bit, and then you write that little bit, and then that little bit, and then you sort of put them into some sort of order. Though I've often think you'd be as well throwing him in the air and just going with what lands. So you probably get the critics going, oh, what an, you know, an innovative way of sequencing the book. But, you know, you spread them out on the kitchen floor and you move them around. And then collectively, you come to an understanding with what you've lived through or, you know, the subject. And so I think poetry's really good for that. And it has metaphor, which allows you to say the unsayable and expand on the impact. And also that it, importantly, that it gives something to the reader. You trust the reader, so that's a big part of it. So I was thinking a bit like a washing line when you peg out your own laundry, but you leave space for the reader to peg theirs up as well.
Yes, lovely. Something you said there, though, about the writing of a poem. You just write it as if it's the work of seconds, and I wonder, is it the work of seconds? Is it getting easier? Is it not this work?
No, I think the better you get at it, or the more you get used to it, the longer it takes. Because when I started out, I thought I was fantastic. And I was just talking about this at CB1 last night. Yes, I thought I was fantastic, and I wasn't fantastic at all. You talk like Norman McCabe, I think you quoted that, like, you know, how long does it take you to write one? It's 2 fags. It's at least 200 fags for me. There's an analogy. So my wife, Helen Ivory, Blood Axe poet, who's a natural poet. And I've got this analogy where there's this wall, like in a walled garden or something, with 50 doors all open, swing open towards you, apart from one, which opens onto this wildflower meadow, beautiful meadow and sunshine. And Helen kind of strolls, she writes about 4 foot away from me, bear in mind. I'm not even, like Ringo wasn't the best drummer in the Beatles. I'm not the best poet in the house, and there's only 2 of us. So, and Helen kind of thinks about stuff, she reads, and then she kind of walks up to the one door that goes through into the wild, beautiful wildflower meadow, and there's this beautiful poem. I kind of put my head down and run at doors for quite a long time, and then at some point I spill out through the one door, dazed and battered, with this sort of broken thing in my hand. So I kind of know what it needs to be, but I don't, I have to work really hard to get there. And then you get there and you go, well, why didn't you just write that down in the first place?
How do you know when it's cooked, though? After, is this an editing process? Is it even getting near the edges of it even starting? Like, how do you know when it's, you're weaving it in?
Well, I'm part of a workshop group, so that's usually, I don't know. I mean, I can't remember who said it, but the poet said, you know, it's never finished, only abandoned. And because especially when I'm doing the show stuff where I learn by heart, then that becomes the last part of the editing process, because as you read it again and again to learn it, you change things slightly as you sort of experiment with the sound of it, I suppose. So it's, yeah, I kind of sweat blood. But that also means, because there's poems in here that occasionally a poem just writes itself. But then I kind of think, that can't be very good. It didn't hurt enough. Yeah.
I think the idea of performance is really interesting, though, especially because, as you say, you've done these shows and all the rest. But I think I thought that, especially during COVID, interviewing poets who read to a Zoom screen, which is still going on, of course, and is very valid. But landing a poem in a room of people where that get that absolute feedback or reverb or whatever happens.
Well, yeah, it was great. I've just come back, you know, like CB1. And it's not an easy book, this. And sort of, I was kind of, but I determined that every poem in this book would get a public outing, rather than relying on the old showboating favourites that you know people are going to like. And it went really well. I sold the most books, you know, and I mean, it was a poetry audience. So I'm kind of learning to sort of do that. But I enjoy reading. I think I'm a good reader of sort of work. I wouldn't describe myself as a performance poet anymore. I mean, there's some very good people who are happy to be called performance poets, but there's a kind of, I remember Clive James being interviewed at Oldborough, and the interviewer said, "So what about performance poets?" And he went, "Idiots." And then that was that. And then he moved on and everyone in the room went, and I thought, and I, sometimes you can see why, but it's just a label. So I just like to, you know, and I, because I do funny stuff and I do cabaret, like Banks Head the Gun, which I really love doing, laugh out loud, so, you know, and I like doing that, but I also do this.
Yeah,
and it's a kind of strange combination, which sometimes does you a favour and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah.
A broad tonal portfolio. That's it, yeah. It's wonderful. I've got a couple of tiny little questionettes, but I wonder if we could have a third and final poem, Martin, just whatever one you would like to chair.
Oh, crikey. So what have we done? We've done Bear and we've done Sand. We should maybe do one of the personal ones from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know where this came from. I think it was something Tiffany Atkinson about six. I've always loved kids, like small kids who were feral. I was stood at a festival talking to Simon Munnery, a great comedian. He's on at the Arts Centre this Wednesday, people. Really, really brilliant man. But he's quite tatty, you know. And there was this little girl, like it was Lord of the Flies kind of thing. She had an armful of sticks and she was gouging holes in the grass. And I said, "Oh, I love kids like that, son of this, a little savage." And it was his daughter. And when I last saw him, I mentioned it to him and he went, "Oh, yeah, no, yeah, she wants iPhones now." So, you know, and stuff. So I kind of started there, but this is the boy who replaced his mother. The boy who replaced his mother with a stick he found and ran along the railings in the park, by setting fire to the bandstand and watching from the dark, by constructing her from a carno with 27 moving parts, by drawing her from memory on a mannequin in the window of a store, by the Queen of Hearts flicking against the wheel spokes of his bike, by shoplifting chocolate bars, by bullying, by telling jokes, by keeping goal, by showing off, by saying fuck, by chiselling her from bog oak, by shaping her from shadow play and smoke, by puddling rain softly in the small of his palm, by doing well, by singing badly, and by writing her in a book.
Just a couple of tiny little questions,
okay,
if I may. When do you think of poems most, by which I don't mean sort of when does a poem come to you, on, you know, or in what circumstances do poems come to you? But is it, are poems a morning idea? Is it after you've been out and about and then a poem might come, or is it not as simple?
Morning, I write in the mornings. I don't often carry on into the afternoon. I think Ted Hughes used to have his after lunch nap, and then he got two mornings, he said. So it comes, I try and write in sort of set number of days, like 3 or 4 days. My concentration is really poor. I'm a bit ADHD. So a lot of ideas come from listening to other poets. So I spent thousands of pounds over the years going to poetry readings, and they'll read something, and then halfway through the first poem, I'm gone. And then I'm sort of, I'm not stealing, you know, or anything like that. It just sparks something in my thing. I'm there. And so I write in the mornings, but the rest of that time I'm writing, I can be in that zone. So if I'm shopping, I'm out and about, I'll see things. And but I remember there's a poem about called The Vineyard Boys in Whistle, which is a children's home poem. And I want it to be anthemic. We are, and in some way, and it just took like half a dozen characters that I kind of disguised that I knew from that time. And I was out and about, and Helen was in watching, and she was watching Quadrophenia. And I opened the front door, and the first thing I heard was, "We are, we are, we are the Mods." And I went, "There it is. We are the Vineyard Boys." And so stuff like that happens. Like, you know, so I'm kind of on those days when I'm writing, even when I'm not writing, that's where my head is. And so you sort of steal from everyday life and things that you see, like the, you know, the sand poem. I could say, "Oh, I remember where I got that image from." The "Can I Help You" badges and the beauty queens from Martin Parr photograph at New Brighton and stuff. There's, you know, so
I imagine the not writing and the just the watching and listening and looking is as important as the actual writing.
Yeah. And I sort of make notes and email myself stuff. So I've been taking a break from writing because I've been working on the shed. But I thought, well, is this the end? I kind of emptied everything into this book. You know, what are you going to do now? But I, you know, I've got an, and then I started to, I mean, I already had an idea of what I might do next, but whether it becomes a thing, but I've started to have ideas. So I just make a note and shove it in a folder. And then some of them like spark, you know, but you need that little, it's called MacGuffin, that lifts it from just being an anecdote. Because a lot of, you know, when judging poetry, you see a lot of diary entries or an anecdote. It's got to have, you've got to take it off somewhere, or for me, to enjoy it anyway.
I imagine it has to, even if it is your anecdote, it has to speak to a universality. It can't just be your anecdote. It's got to speak beyond.
That's right. So like the boy, you know, you replaced his mother. So there's, you know, that isn't what, well, some of those things happened. I didn't set fire to a bandstand, but something similar. It's just like, so the language leads you as well. Yeah. But I definitely bullied people and I definitely put the, you know, there's the stuff in there that kind of did happen, but it's whether it has that wider reach, I suppose, depends on how it, you know, includes itself.
Which poets or poems made you want to make poems?
Yeah, well, I have a few that because I was a kind of, when I started writing, I was sort of, I'm going to write like Raymond Carver straight, you know, and no image, you know, sort of straightforward, which it turns out it's really hard to do, and even Raymond Carver couldn't do it, his editor kind of. So poets that are out there are like Charles Simic was really important, and John Berryman's Dream Song, which is not like how I write at all, which is really useful. So I can, and I read like George Surtees quite a lot because of the energy of the way he writes. So I often start writing a terza rima and then it falls apart or runs into, and then I break it apart. But what you've got is these really, because it's a form, but a rolling thing, you've got these assonants and sounds that go off each other. So you've got good things, and then you thought you were going to make a horse, but you make a giraffe sort of thing. And a lot of female writers that I really like, Holly Hopkins' recent book, read, Jenny Padgett. I mean, Norwich is full of them, Julie Webb. So it's funny, my music collection, I do this Tower of Song kind of blog on Facebook of all the music I've ever owned. It's like 12% women. I keep stats, I'm a bit spectrumy when that comes. So hardly, you know, but when it comes to poetry, it's completely the other way around. I generally like Caroline Bird and stuff that's not like mine, really, especially when I'm looking to sort of get ideas. So it gets me warm, gets you going, and so I'll reach out for Charles, these writers that write very much metaphorical and allegorical, you know, and there'll be things in there that I will sort of give them my treatment and make them mine, but they've sparked an idea.
Magpies. We're all magpies, aren't we?
Yeah, and books like Katie Evans Bush's recent book. Yeah. Fantastic, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. All that said, Mark, here I'm holding here this lovely copy of The Remaining Men. Where can people catch you? This book is now in the world, I'm right to say.
It is, yeah.
It's out there. You can buy it in your...
They can buy it. You can buy it from Cinnamon Press, or better still, sorry, Cinnamon Press, you can just Google, go on my website and there's a books page, and I have a card reader and a sum up thing. So what's happened to poetry, eh? Helen and I did a reading after lockdown, and it was always cash, and you know, you've got this sort of hopeful tub of coins and fivers to give change. And then people were like coming at you with credit cards. What's happening? So we bought a card reader, which is only 30 quid. It's amazing. It's fantastic.
Brilliant. So no excuses.
So if they just Google me, go on my book page, and they can see all of the books, and they just click on the book, and then it sounds like it's me, and so I get an email, and then I post them a book.
Brilliant. What could be better? And we started this conversation with a chat about you've been out and about. Where next? Where can people see you in the next couple of months?
I'm going to Halesworth as part of the Ink Festival, doing a sort of theatre show, really. It's kind of poetry in places, but it's a bit blurry around that idea. And that's 12 o'clock on Thursday in Halesworth. I don't know, but it seems to work. It's a really popular festival. And then the following week, I'm doing that in London at the Cockpit Theatre on the 19th. And then the week after that, we're going to Grimsby. Helen and I are reading in Grimsby Library and running a workshop. And then after, I'm going to Coventry and Leeds and all sorts. Yeah, we've got a lot coming up.
It's a national tour. That's absolutely brilliant. Okay, I think we'll end there. Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peggy. Lovely. Yeah, it's been lovely to chat. Nice to talk. Yeah.
A huge thank you to Martin for his time, and make sure to pick up a copy of The Remaining Men from your favourite bookshop.
If you have any questions or want to get in touch, you can find us at Writers Centre on Twitter and Instagram. We're on Facebook, and you can sign up to the NCW newsletter at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. We're also scheduling a mailbag episode for a few weeks' time. So if you have any pressing questions for us about NCW, about the podcast, about the craft of writing, or anything else, then do drop us an email at info@nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk.
As a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. You can make a donation to NCW today by visiting our website and clicking on the Support Us page. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard today, please do subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and a positive review, because it helps other writers and readers to find us.
Thank you again, everyone. Keep writing, and we'll catch you in the next episode.